The Federal Reserve this week left interest rates alone and says it will be not raising rates for all of the rest of 2019. What does this mean for the economy and what does it mean for you? Joining us this morning is Mark Hamrick, the Bureau Chief and Senior Economic Analyst at Bankrate.com. Mark, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Well, this seems like good news on the front of it. No more interest rates for 2019.
Well, it depends on how you look at it. The economy is not able to sustain any further rate increases. Is taken as good news from those who, let's say, fear the impacts of rising rates and other aspects of monetary policy that are seen as restrictive. But let's think about the fact that essentially the Fed downgraded the outlook for the economy across any number of different metrics, including in its written statement, and it's a somewhat more, let's say, eclectic summary of economic projections, which is a collection of data points, including things like growth and the unemployment rate and inflation, the sort of collective view of members of the Federal Open Market Committee. So, you know, we're in this kind of an interesting situation right now where maybe the financial markets to some degree are happy to see that the outlook is so weak that the Fed doesn't have confidence to raise interest rates in the near term. Let's leave the second half of the year as a bit of an open question, simply because we just don't know how any number of different variables are yet going to be resolved. But obviously, as you alluded there, the so-called dot plot, which is also basically the outlook on interest rate increases on the part of FOMC members. The majority of those members did indeed forecast no rate hike this year and possibly only one over the next couple of years. So, we're in an interesting situation right now, to be sure.
Yeah, and, as we started off the year, we were talking about perhaps four interest rate hikes this year. And so that's a big jump backwards. And then the other part of it that I think if you're looking to the future is concerning, as you mentioned, is the look at annual growth. Federal Reserve says maybe 2.1% when all is said and done this year, down to 1.9% next year, maybe 1.8% in 2021. That's a significantly lower than what the White House wants.
Well, let's just say I think the White House is making those judgments based more on faith than on data, and the Federal Reserve is doing so literally on data. And, you know, the Fed is also sort of preaching from its own book, right? In other words, if you have to sell from your own book, that's what you sell. It looks as if upon revision, even GDP for the full year of 2018 may not notch that highly touted 3% level. And no matter where one stands on being a fan of the president or not being a fan of the president or somewhere in between, we all ultimately cheer for the U.S. economy. And to the extent that the president repeatedly has talked about 3% growth, possibly much, much higher than that, we're not going to see 3% growth for 2018 upon revision, and obviously are not going to see it in 2019 or 2020. So we all hope that the U.S. economy could continue to stretch its legs as it approaches 10 years of an economic expansion this summer. But this is a bit of a senior citizen of an expansion, and therefore we shouldn't necessarily expect it to set a world record on the marathon.
Yeah, that's a very good way of putting it, Mark. Give it a little extra time to cross at the crosswalk. give us a sense of when we see growth numbers falling like this and economic growth slowing, what this means for all of us individually. Are we going to continue to see the job market go? I mean, obviously we're not going to see our credit card interest rates go up again probably this year. So there are some good news and bad news things, right?
Well, that's right. And so, at Bankrate, we come from, let's say, some interesting DNA from over the years where, you know, in the pre-internet era, one of the things that people were most interested in that Bankrate crunched was data, for example, on certificates of deposit. People always wanted to know, as to some degree they still do. The deposits business is one that's improved as interest rates have gone higher. So we have been, let's say, closely aligned with savers' interests. And, when we came sort of out of 7 years of interest rates at record low levels, 0 to 0.25% as determined by the Federal Reserve, you know, my feeling was, and I think I've asked a couple of Federal Reserve chairs this question in news conferences, you know, what do you have to say to the savers of essentially America, who sometimes feel that they are the forgotten casualties of the low interest rate policy. And ultimately what the likes of Chairman Bernanke or Chair Yellen would say, and I haven't gotten a question yet to Jerome Powell, but ultimately they'd say that, you know, we have to help the broader economy to the degree that we have a blunt instrument in the federal funds rate, our major tool for adjusting the pace of the economy. And ultimately we're trying to help everybody by adjusting interest rates accordingly, and then the takeaway from that is that a sort of collateral damage is what happens to savers. And so that was on my mind at the news conference this week. I wasn't able to get that question in, but who knows, I may bring it back around if I can at the next news conference. But to your point on the borrowing side, yeah, the news there is better. And whether someone is a common visitor to our website at bankrate.com or, listening to us here talking about it here today, one of the major stories of the last 48 hours has been that interest rates, mortgage rates, fell again this week to their lowest level in 13 months, and now we have the benchmark 30-year fixed mortgage rate at 4.44%, and that is below where it was a year ago at 4.58. Now, that's the national average. You can find the Chicago area rates on our site as well. But the point is that we have the yield of the 10-year Treasury falling. Essentially, investors are now betting more on a kind of a global weakness scenario, and that feeds into the 10-year Treasury yield, and then that, of course, then is essentially reflected in what we see in mortgage rates. Similarly, for borrowers, we probably have come close to the cap on credit card rates, at least in terms of what the marketplace is determining for the near term. And so, yeah, for borrowers, relatively good news. They shouldn't necessarily see further restriction in borrowing rates. For savers, you're going to have to be more judicious and continue to shop around, because it really does pay to get those rates that are actually above the national average when it comes to return on savings.
We're talking about the Fed's decision this week to leave interest rates alone, maybe for the rest of the year. Mark, I'm interested to see what you'll be watching as we move forward here in terms of data points. Will it be housing? Will it be jobs? Will we notice first if something decides to go south and maybe force the Fed to change its mind?
Well, of course, all of the above. But in terms of some of the things that people may not necessarily think about, with respect to, let's say, inflection points in the U.S. economy. Obviously, there are some potential news developments that we need to get past, if indeed we can get past them, and those would be the U.S.-China trade talks, the complexion of tariffs going forward, obviously affecting American consumers and businesses who have to pay all of those. Brexit obviously continues to be a story to watch with developments overnight. We hope that there's not a hard Brexit, because obviously that will add to further weakening of the European economy, which is already weak. And then in terms of data points, I think that ones that people probably need to pay more attention to are those involving sentiment. So indeed, how consumers are feeling, and they indicate that they are broadly feeling pretty good. We've seen some weakening in business sentiment, and we'll see whether that further deteriorates. And then, of course, as you said at the outset, obviously the monthly employment report is, for me, the key data point or set of data points for the month. And then if we see some further resurgence in housing based upon those falling mortgage interest rates, so that would be welcome indeed.
There's a really good piece that you've written on, and we're going to link out to it, how to bulletproof your finances against an economic downturn. A lot of good advice here about what to do career-wise with debt, with savings. All of these things are important. Talk to us a little bit about this, if you will.
Well, let's talk, first of all, about maintaining one's career. Now is the time for wage earners to make sure that their career networks are as solid as they need to be for the possibility that one needs to look for a job. The time to do that isn't when you're at the crisis stage. So, like, should I put on a Band-Aid after I've already been admitted to the emergency room? And then one thing that people don't think about as often connected to personal finance, and that is health. And so exercise and just being mindful of one's health, getting those checkups, doing the the test that the doctor asks for, whether it's, let's say, when you're past the age of 50, like a colonoscopy or something like that. There are significant financial negative impacts if indeed you're not mindful of your health. And then the basic things, build that emergency savings, build the retirement savings, because the failure to do that ends up being the number one financial regret on the part of the Americans that we survey.
Yeah, and I like the one segment, too, devote more time to your money. We have been talking a lot lately on the program here about just learning basic financial knowledge. That's always a good thing.
Well, you know, I feel like in this modern day of information that we all sort of envelop ourselves in, obviously we toil in that world, you and I, the rest of the world is so overwhelmed by so much information. It's like, well, what should I be paying attention to? What are the new movies on Netflix this month, right? And so the other part of that is, hey, let's just invest a little bit of time in ourselves about being knowledgeable about money. And as my colleague Greg McBride likes to say with respect to savings, instead of spending the money first, save the money first, and ultimately you are paying yourself first.
Absolutely. Mark, it's always great talking with you. Thank you for being with us this morning.
My great pleasure to be on WGN and with you, Steve. Thanks so much.
All right. Have a great weekend. It's Mark Hamrick, Bureau Chief and Senior Economic Analyst at Bankrate.com. And make sure you follow Mark as well on Twitter at Hamrickisms. And we're going to link out to his story on your financial situation and things you can do to sort of safeguard your personal finances against an economic downturn in the podcast of The Opening Bell a little bit later this morning at WGNRadio.com.
WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning again, everyone. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here with us on our Friday edition of The Opening Bell. Some developing news this morning involving Boeing and the 737 MAX aircraft. Earlier in the program, we reported that Indonesia, considering canceling Garuda Indonesia, the airline there, considering canceling 49 of the Boeing 737 MAX jets on order from Boeing at a $6 billion price. It's unclear whether those would be swapped out for another model or if the order will just be canceled outright. Lion Air in Indonesia, which was the victim of that crash in October, has also been considering canceling future orders. And also this morning, new Boeing says it will install an extra safety alarm in the cockpits of all of its 737 MAX aircraft after the criticism from these two fatal crashes. The Boeing group has decided to include a warning light in the new 737 MAX planes and will retrofit all existing ones. According to a person familiar with the situation quoted in the story, the alarm will tell pilots if two angle of attack sensors, which indicate the angle of the plane's nose, disagree, a sign that one is not working. Again, that a published report this morning, Boeing not commenting on this. Let's bring in Brian Summers this morning. Brian is Senior Aviation Business Editor for Skift.com, and he is with us via Skype this morning from Los Angeles. Brian, I want to talk more about how the Boeing 737 MAX story is impacting airlines. I know these planes have been grounded, and there's some forward guidance about what to expect going forward. Let's begin there.
Well, Steve, it depends where in the world you're talking about. Here in the United States, U.S. airlines are in pretty good shape. Only three of them fly the MAX. That's United, American, and Southwest. The MAX is such a new airplane. That's, of course, why we have the problems. But it also means that no U.S. airline has all that many of them. So I think Southwest has the most. Maybe they have 34 or so. Spring is not that big of a time for travel. There's a bit of a peak around the Easter weekend. But other than that, airlines have a lot of slack in their fleets, and they're basically able to do, more flying. So even though they're losing their 737 MAX fleets this month, they have other 737s that were probably scheduled for downtime or some low-level maintenance that they can push back into service. So the U.S. carriers say that so far the impact on customers is minimal. And one way you can know that they're serious about this, Steve, is because they have not updated their guidance to Wall Street, right? So that if this was a really a material problem for them, they would go out and they would tell Wall Street, we think we're going to make a little less revenue than expected this quarter. They haven't done that yet. It doesn't mean they won't. But what is notable is that two Canadian airlines, that's WestJet, a low-cost carrier, and Air Canada, have a greater proportion of MAX jets in their fleet. So they don't have all that many of them, but they just have fewer airplanes than the U.S. airlines. And they went out to investors, I think, last week, and they said, we are pausing our guidance. So they didn't give new guidance, but they said, what we gave you before probably isn't going to be true, and we need some time to work this out. So I don't know if folks are planning to fly any of the Canadian airlines in the near future, but if they do, you know, your chances of being delayed or canceled are probably bigger if you're flying WestJet or Air Canada than if you're flying American, United, or Southwest.
Yeah, and Brian, I did see a story about from Canada about their contingency plans and that they were planning on not having the 737 MAX until July.
Yes, you know, you don't know how much of this is actionable information that they have and how much of it is erring on the side of caution, right? Because if they end up getting the MAX a little bit earlier than July, then it becomes good news. You can put it back in the system. You can fly more than expected. But, you know, if this delay runs later than they think it does, then they're in trouble. So if they put the MAX back on the schedule, say on May 15th, out of wishful thinking, and they don't get it back until July, then they've inconvenienced a lot of travelers. So I just don't know what data they have. You know, we've talked about this on the show before. End of June, July, August, that's when North American and actually European travel demand ramps up. Every airline is scheduling every airplane to fly as much as it can. So if this thing does last into July, people are going to find more delays, more cancellations, because at that point, you can't really do more than less. You already are flying your airplanes as much as you can.
Last week on the program, I asked you about the FAA administrator position. Since we talked, the White House has announced plans to nominate Stephen Dixon for that job. He's a former Delta Airlines guy.
Yeah, you know, this is sort of interesting, and I know people are curious or even upset that the FAA, which is the major safety regulator for the United States aviation system, has gone with a former airline guy as its new administrator. It probably doesn't look great. But you know what? When I talk to people, they're pretty pleased with this decision. They're happy that the FAA has chosen somebody who, you know, knows aviation, knows what the major issues are. You may remember several months ago, there was a lot of fear that President Trump wanted to choose his personal pilot as the FAA administrator. And that's somebody that probably does not have the 360-degree view of aviation, like somebody who was a senior executive at a U.S. airline. So this is certainly better than that. There's no doubt that this gentleman knows the industry. Could he be too cushy with airlines? I don't know. We're just going to have to wait and see.
One of your other stories this week is kind of a cool story. I know we all look for discount airfare when we want to fly. And the airlines have made changes to its the revenue strategies in recent months that could possibly impact discount tickets.
You're right, Steve. I definitely geek out of airfares. I spend a lot of my free time just playing on my own, and I've noticed some patterns over the last several months. I don't know if the listeners have as well, but this story that I wrote focused on two airlines, United and Alaska, and they both have recently moved to new strategies for how they sell tickets. So United did something interesting over the last 2 years or so, but they're getting even better at it. They're holding more tickets into the last minute for business travelers, those lawyers and consultants in Chicago working downtown that have to go to New York and they only have 2 days notice, and they're literally willing to pay any price. And United's new executive team said, you know what, in the past, United tried to sell too many tickets in advance at a discount. They didn't leave enough seats open last minute for these business travelers. It is among these airlines, you know what, how many business travelers show up at the last minute? How many seats should we leave available? People know if Chicago to New York ticket on sale for $99 one way, 3 months in advance, somebody's going to grab it. So you know that you can sell that seat in advance at the right price, but you may just want to hold it free, just hoping a business traveler comes last minute and buys it. So that's where United has gone. Alaska Airlines has gone the other way. You may remember that Alaska 2 years ago or so acquired Virgin America. Virgin America used to have this United model. They flew two big cities. Alaska bought Virgin America. They looked at the data and they said, you know what, these business travelers that you think are going to come at the last minute, sometimes they come and pay you a lot of money, but very often they never show up. You don't earn the revenue, and it would probably be best if you just book the revenue earlier in the booking curve. So when Alaska took over Virgin America, they said, you know what, we'll still leave some expensive tickets open at the last minute for business travelers, but we're going to sell more account tickets 4, 6, 8, 10 weeks in advance. So if you go to alaskaair.com and you look at San Francisco to New York, which is an old Virgin America route, you will probably find more discounts in advance now than you did 3 years ago when the airline was called Virgin America.
All right, Brian, good conversation as always. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Brian Summers is Senior Aviation Business Editor for Skift at skift.com, at Skift on Twitter. Make sure you follow Brian, too, at Brian Summers on Twitter.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, futures are pointing toward a weak open on Wall Street later this morning. Dow, NASDAQ, S&P futures off anywhere from a third to nearly a half a percent this morning. Let's get the latest on agriculture and commodities now. Orion Samuelson is with us this morning. Orion, good morning.
Well, good morning to you. And for the third time in a week, we've had lean hog futures move to close at the daily limit, up $4.50 a hundredweight yesterday. And that's the daily trading limit for today. They won't expand it. But we now have the lean hog contracts up $4.50 a hundredweight across the board. Reason, of course, is China. I think people have learned that it's tough to really believe some of the numbers that China releases. But the story on African swine fever now with 113 outbreaks in China since last August is taking a bigger toll on the hog population in China than previously thought. So $4.50 trading limit yesterday, and that will be repeated again today. And then on the grain market side, Steve, we've got the floods. And the concern is growing on those floods. Missouri governor yesterday declared a state of emergency, and now the delay in planting could become an even bigger factor. We'll get planting intentions report the end of this month, but I'm not sure we know how accurate those numbers will be based on the weather. So couple of challenges that we're facing this morning, sir.
Yeah, and it's really heartbreaking to see some of this flooding, especially in Nebraska and Iowa. I know the governors of those two states said that there could be more than a million heads of cattle or calves who've been lost in the flooding. There's also flooding in southern Illinois, and you know the cost already, I think, in Nebraska of the floods is up to $1 billion. So this could get costly pretty quickly.
Very quickly, and it probably will get higher than $1 billion in Nebraska. One of the emails that I received showed a farmer with his tractor, a front loader, and trying to lift a calf out of the mud because the mud and the water are so deep the calf couldn't do it by himself. And so that's just one of the sad pictures we're getting out of the flooding area. And all of this water that's coming out of the Missouri and the Ohio and the coming into the Mississippi, it's going to cause flooding problems all the way down to the Gulf. And the other concern, of course, is as some of the locks and dams could be closed because of flooding, and that would limit the movement of grain down to the Gulf to the port in New Orleans.
What is on the morning show tomorrow?
Well, on the morning show tomorrow, we're going to be talking markets, and I think we'll be focusing quite a bit on the situation with the hog price and the hog concern for African swine fever. Brian Basting will be our guest as we talk markets tomorrow morning with Max, and I'll be there, of course.
So. All right. Orion, have a great weekend.
You too.
All right, Orion Samuelson with us this morning. The morning show starts at 5 o'clock tomorrow morning right here on 720 WGN. Now the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for Friday, March 22nd. Existing home sales for February and January's wholesale inventories are due today. Housing industry analysts forecast existing home sales coming in at an annual rate of about 5.1 million. That would be an increase from January's 4.94 million. The numbers out mid-morning. Also, the January wholesale inventory figures, experts see a 0.2% increase down from December 1.1% advance. On the earnings calendar, Tiffany and Company and Destination XL Group, just some of the things that could move the markets on this Friday, March the 22nd.